Let's begin by saying that we are living through a very dangerous time. Words written 55 years ago by African-American social critic James Baldwin, addressing a group of educators about how to speak with students about the headlines of the 60s. Well, fast forward to today. Clint Smith is a writer, a PhD candidate at Harvard. His terrific poetry collection is titled Counting Dissent. He's also been a teacher who's struggled with making teaching relevant. Natural disasters, neo-Nazis and white supremacists, battles over NFL football players taking a knee, the threat of nuclear war with North Korea, the repeal of DACA, putting the future of 800,000 immigrants at risk, just some of the things happening outside the classroom. So Clint turned back to James Baldwin. Clint Smith is here to talk about his piece for The New Yorker, James Baldwin's Lessons for Teachers in a Time of Turmoil. Clint, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, put this in context. Tell us about the time in 1963 that Baldwin was talking about.
This was a moment. John F. Kennedy had just been killed. Medgar Evers, who was a prominent NAACP organizer in Mississippi, had just been assassinated. The Birmingham bombing of the four little girls in the church at 16th Street Baptist Church had just taken place. And so this was an incredibly contentious time in the United States with regard to issues of race and inequality and social stratification. And in many ways, you know, revisiting this essay feels as if it could have been written the other day. That's the power of Baldwin and why he's experienced such a sort of renaissance, because his work is in many ways prophetic and his work is speaking to his lifetime. But many of the issues that he was wrestling with are things that we're struggling with today.
So take us back in time for you. You were teaching in a high school and you were feeling this disconnect between the sentence structure that you had to teach and what you knew that kids were thinking about. Tell us about what you encountered.
Right. I think I came into the classroom and I initially was like deeply committed to pushing back against the sort of normative structures of standardized testing and the idea that the singular metrics for student success should be tied to their math or their reading score. And I wanted to engage in a sort of broader project of helping students develop a critical consciousness and deeper sense of empathy in the world. But as is often the case, you find yourself becoming tied to the metrics of success in that environment. And there was a moment where I was teaching about sentence structure and syntax, and Trayvon Martin had just been killed, and a myriad of students that they knew from other schools had just been killed. And I think I fell victim to the fear of wanting to create an apolitical space in the classroom. And revisiting a talk to teachers served as a really important reminder that the very decision to not discuss certain things in your classroom is in and of itself a political decision, because my students' lives are impacted by political decisions every single day. And I think it's important for teachers to think about ways to try to facilitate and create a space where they can engage in those conversations in a meaningful way.
Well, how do you do that in such a divisive climate? You write about a friend of yours, a teacher in Washington in an elementary school. He had to answer questions about those protests in Charlottesville, white supremacists marching out in the open with Nazis, when a man rammed his car through a crowd of counter-protesters, killed a woman. You know, a student asks, why was somebody so angry that they wanted to drive a car through people asking for their rights? That's almost an easier question, you know, that there is hate. Let's say taking on a debate over whether or not, you know, football players should kneel during the national anthem. That's one that parents might not want you to take up in the classroom.
Yeah, so I think oftentimes what happens is we conflate the idea that certain things should be discussed in a classroom with the notion that a teacher is going to indoctrinate students with their own beliefs. And I think that that is not actually what critical pedagogy is. Critical pedagogy is this idea that you are going to create a space in your classroom in which students are able to develop their own sense of critical consciousness and engagement with the world. And what does it mean for me as a critically and culturally responsive educator to provide the space for you to understand the social and historical and political context that led us to this moment, where people's arguments on either side are stemming from? And what does it mean for you to have conversations with your classmates about these issues that might push you to think differently about something? So I think we really have to make sure that we're not ignoring these issues in our classrooms, but instead tackling them head on.
Well, because so much of our real history has been ignored in our classrooms. And that was one of James Baldwin's points, that they're sort of fairy tales.
Right.
You know, revolutionaries in America wanted to overthrow the British who had control over them while they owned slaves. You know, Reconstruction was a falsehood, that it quickly became almost re-enslavement. Learning that Roosevelt pretty much cut blacks out of the New Deal.
Right.
That post-World War II, blacks were pretty much cut out of all the financial advances there because they couldn't get loans and buy homes because of redlining. And so decades later, don't have that wealth to pass on. I can see, though, that in some schools, that might be tricky.
I think it demands a certain level of courage from the administrators, a certain level of courage from the teachers. And as you brought up, you know, the New Deal is something that we're always taught is the most progressive series of legislative acts that have ever been signed. They are what created the contemporary middle class. They are responsible for decades and decades of intergenerational wealth and upward mobility, which they are, but only for white people, right? Because black people were not given access to Social Security, minimum wage protection, health care, housing mortgages, the GI Bill, and all of the different things that created the social bedrock of intergenerational wealth in the early 20th century. And so if a student doesn't understand that certain things at the beginning of the 20th century that are responsible for the accumulation of wealth were given to one demographic of people and then not given to a different demographic of people, any social scientist will tell you it is inevitable that they will experience disparate outcomes. And again, but this is something that, you know, many of our students don't know, but also many of our teachers aren't being taught. And so it also demands that we think differently about how we're engaging in professional development. When I was a teacher, I never had professional development conversations around the history of the neighborhood where I taught or what it meant to put my students' academic experiences in conversation with mass incarceration and housing segregation and immigration and food insecurity. Because we so often operate under the false pretense that our classrooms are these somehow sanctuaries that are not affected by the rest of the world, but our students leave our classrooms and go out into a world in which they are deeply affected by the socio-political phenomena that they experience every day.
There have always been whites who have walked with blacks in the civil rights struggle, but it seems like there's a slightly different tone now. And I may be wrong, but it feels like it's more whites talking about their own white privilege as opposed to wanting equal rights for blacks. And I'm thinking of Greg Popovich, coach of the San Antonio Spurs, in the midst of the whole NFL kneeling controversy. Here's what he had to say on the team's media day.
There has to be an uncomfortable element in the discourse for anything to change. People have to be made to feel uncomfortable, and especially white people, because we're comfortable. We still have no clue of what being born white means.
Does that encourage you?
It does. I'm not sure what critical race theory courses Greg Popovich has secretly been sitting in, but I was incredibly heartened to hear him speak that way. And, you know, in that interview, he goes on to talk about how race and how whiteness is actually something that is not real. It's something that is made up. And for one of the best coaches in the history of the National Basketball Association to be digging deep into, like, literature around race and racecraft. When the Irish came to the United States, they weren't considered white. When the Italians came to the United States, they weren't considered white. But what happens over time is that the line of whiteness is always moved in order to maintain social stratification and to maintain power. And the line will continue to move.
And again, how do you have that conversation about white privilege in a classroom where you have poor white kids who don't feel at all privileged?
Yeah, and I think that that demands a nuanced understanding of how it is that allow us to navigate the world as both people who are oppressed and people who are complicit in oppression. On one end, as a black person, I am a member of a community that has been historically oppressed. And as a man and as a straight person, I am part of a community that benefits from the existence of patriarchy, notions of how gender operates. It's like when you're in the water park and you're on the lazy river, you can say, well, I'm not doing anything to swim along, but you are allowing yourself to be part of the current. And it's hard to say, I'm going to get off of this proverbial raft and like walk against the current when it would be much easier for me to sit on the raft. You know, some people will come up to me and they'll say, well, how do you have a conversation about race with young children? And the important thing is that we've done this for a long time with regard to the environment, right? And so you don't go to a second grader and say, well, centuries of climate change means Indonesia and Miami will be engulfed in water and not exist within the next 20 years. So say goodbye to those people. That would be irresponsible. Similarly, we wouldn't go to a second grader and say, white supremacy is a fundamentally ingrained facet of American history and has been since 1619, and there's nothing you can do about it. What you can say, and what we do in the context of the environment, is we talk about recycling or to turn the lights off, right? You scaffold the conversation to be appropriate for the person of that age. And similarly, I think you can have conversations pushing back against the idea of colorblindness, for example, right? Making sure that young people grow up understanding that race has very different and real implications, and we shouldn't pretend as if it doesn't exist, but we should appreciate each person for who they are and the different facets of their identity.
That's Clint Smith, a writer, PhD candidate at Harvard, author of Counting Dissent, and also a teacher. We'll post James Baldwin's A Talk to Teachers at hereandnow.org. Clint, thanks so much for reminding us of it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.